Good afternoon, family. Happy Sabbath to everyone here, everyone listening in on the webcast. Wherever you are, I hope you're staying strong, and I hope you're doing well. Let's start today by turning in our Bibles to Luke chapter 21. Please turn to Luke 21. Here, Jesus is telling Peter and John and James and Andrew about a future time, a difficult time. And you have these four men gathered around him, and he says this in verse 9, Luke 21, verse 9, "But when you hear of wars and commotions, do not be terrified, for these things must come to pass first, but the end will not come immediately." Jesus is speaking of the precursor to the end times. And while I make no prediction where we are, on any timeline, I want to focus in on one of the words used here by Jesus. He says there will be commotions. That word means uncertainty or confusion, and it's derived from a Greek word meaning unstable. It's the same word found in 1 Corinthians 14 in that famous verse, "God is not the author of confusion." And again, while I'm not making any predictions on the timeline where we are, but I think we can all agree this is a time of confusion, of uncertainty, of instability in the world. And Christ said here, "Do not be terrified," because he knows it's human nature to respond to uncertain times by getting anxious or worried or terrified. So what can we do instead? There's something really powerful that we can do. If we turn over to Psalm 74. Psalm 74, the context here of this psalm is it's a time of destruction going on around Asaph, the writer of the psalm. And in verse 3, he mentions, the enemy's destroyed everything in the sanctuary. In other words, all of God's holy things are under attack. I'm going to be reading from the New American Standard Bible. Let's start in verse 10. Psalm 74, verse 10. "How long, God, will the enemy taunt you? Why do you withdraw your hand, even your right hand? Extend it from your chest and destroy them." Asaph is saying, "God, are you not going to do anything about what's going on?" I mean, there's a sense of urgency in his words. "God, do something, please, now." Drop down to verse 19. He says, "Do not give the soul of your turtle dove to the wild animal. Do not forget the life of your afflicted forever." So he uses the word turtle dove. That's a term of endearment, meaning someone that's cherished. He's saying, don't let your people, whom you cherish, whom you love, don't let them be ravaged by these beasts that are coming in, destroying and attacking everything. In other words, he sees the chaos that's going on around him, and the life, the world, the existence that he knows is under attack. He must be feeling, this is unstable, this is uncertain, where are we headed, what's next? And to me, it sounds a lot like today, as I feel like a lot of God's holy things are being more and more openly attacked. And I find myself seeing everything that's going on, wondering, what's next? And Asaph, being in this situation, what does he do? Verse 20, he simply says, "God, consider the covenant." It's interesting. Instead of simply saying, "God, save us," he goes to God and says, "God, remember your covenant. Remember those promises that you made. A promise to love your people and not utterly destroy them. A promise that if we humbled ourselves, you would heal us and restore us in our land." So today I want to examine some promises made by God. And I want to think about that. God, who created everything, has given promises to us. And so with these promises, instead of just being facts written down in our Bible, I want us to get really familiar with them so they become powerful truths that we can arm ourselves with. So when we face uncertainty, we can go to God and say, "God, remember these promises." The title of this message is Specifically and Boldly Claiming God's Promises. Specifically and boldly claiming God's promises. I heard one of our ministers say there's over 5,400 promises in the Bible. First I thought, wow, what grace. My next thought was, how many of those can I actually name? We're going to look at three specific promises from God today. So by the end, hopefully we know at least those three. But before going through those, I want to look at what our attitude and approach to the promises should be. Please turn to Malachi. Malachi is the last book in the Old Testament. Look at Malachi 3. God here is speaking through Malachi to his people, and we'll read verse 10. Malachi 3, verse 10 says, "Bring all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house. And try me now in this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such a blessing that there will not be room enough to receive it." You know, there's a promise right here within this verse, but we turn not to examine that promise. We turn to notice how God presents this promise. What does he say? He says, "Try me now in this." He challenges them. Just try me and see what happens. You're presenting this way almost like a dare. He's saying, come and claim this promise from me. It inspires action on our part. It engenders a relationship because it makes it personal. You feel like he's talking to you. Come to me and claim this promise. The certainty of the language, see what I will do, promotes confidence for us. Let's see an example of someone who boldly claimed a promise from God. Please turn to Psalm 89. Psalm 89 is a song by Ethan, the Ezrahite. The word Ethan means strong and optimistic. And in his psalm here, he starts off by praising God and enumerating all the promises that God had made to David. Then in the next few verses, he essentially is asking God, have you forgotten or renounced these covenant promises? Let's pick it up in verse 46. Psalm 89, verse 46. Double check and make sure that's right. Yes. How long, Lord, will you hide yourself forever? Verse 47. Remember how short my time is. Now verse 49. Lord, where are your former loving kindnesses, which you swore to David in your truth? And Ethan is saying exactly what it sounds like here. God, you swore, you promised certain things. Where are they? Oh, and by the way, hurry up because my time is short. You know, this is a pretty bold statement. But Hebrews 4 tells us we should be bold. And that word in Hebrews means to speak frankly or openly. Do you approach God that way? There's other examples in the Bible where our ancestors were very bold with God. Recall Jacob wrestling with God in Genesis 32. And God says, let me go for the day breaks. And Jacob responds, I will not let you go unless you bless me. And God did not punish him. He blessed him. Now thinking about doing something like this makes me almost uncomfortable. But then we have to remember, it's not about Jacob or Ethan in this psalm or you or me. It's about what God wants to do. He says, try me now. Come boldly. Claim these promises. And something that I think is important here that can be easily missed is if we want these promises of God, it's our responsibility to go and claim them. I think about the example of being in court, and you've got a judge who their job is to rule justly. That's their job. But they don't go out and find cases to rule on. A case must be brought to them. The person seeking relief must bring the case to them. And in many ways, God encourages that with us. He's saying, yes, I know what you need, but come to me and claim these. And when we go to him, is it more effective to ask for general protection and blessings, which is perfectly fine to do? But think about this. Is it more effective to ask for general protections and blessings or specific protections and blessings that he's promised? Sticking with our court example, if I go to a judge and say, I'm being mistreated, please grant me relief. You know, what are they going to say? Well, they're going to dismiss the case because how are you being mistreated? Under what specific law should I grant you relief? You see, there's a difference between a general plea and a specific one. Have you ever gone to God and asked for his specific promises? We must know the specific promises in order to claim them that way. And not only that, we must know them accurately. You know, again, with the court example, if I go plead a case before a judge, but I don't know the law accurately, they're going to dismiss the case. So for us, what does that mean, knowing God's promises accurately? Lots of times, There's subtle conditions there. And really what I mean to say is we ought to think of God's promises, not that we sit back, you know, we read them, we sit back and receive them. But we must play our very active part. We have a very active part to do, and we must play that role. We must do our part. And we're going to go through those parts of the promises today. So we want to know the specific promises. We want to know them accurately. We want to arm ourselves with these so we can go to God boldly and claim them. So let's look at the promises. Let's read them, consider them, and learn them. Please turn to Psalm 9. Psalm 9. It's unknown exactly when or what life event that David wrote this. And I think that's intentional because it applies no matter the individual circumstance. And I'll be reading from the New Living Translation. Psalm 9, verse 9 says this: "The Lord is a shelter for those oppressed, a refuge in times of trouble. Those who know your name trust in you, for you, O Lord, do not abandon those who search for you." Now, the goal here is to learn this particular promise and have it firmly in our minds. So what is the promise? Well, when things are distressing or threatening, when you look around and you see troubling times, or when you're being oppressed, which means crushed down by someone or something, God promises to be a shelter for you. Barnes notes says, describes a shelter as a place that's inaccessible to the enemy. Think about that. Inaccessible to the enemy. God is shielding us. Psalm 91 says God is our refuge and shelter. He will deliver us from those that try to trap and attack us. The visual example that comes to my mind is the woman caught in adultery, had attackers, had accusers. And what did Jesus do? He dispersed the attackers and accusers, and what was left was him and her. I also picture an old storm shelter from the movies. You see the storm raging outside, and you run in there, you close the door. I'm safe, right? I'm safe. It's a great promise that God's promising here, to be a shelter. But we also must notice there's a few conditions. There's a few things that we must do. The people that God shelters, it says they know him. It says they trust in him. It says they search for him. These are people that, you know, they're not searching for all other possible solutions and protections, and then if nothing else works out, then I'm going to go to God. No, they're seeking God out in particular because they're saying, I trust in you. That word trust means to trust, but also to be confident in your trust. It means where you get your feeling of safety and security. Where do you get your feeling of safety and security? Sticking with the theme of court, sometimes I'm scheduled to be at two courts at one time. And so I have a very good friend of mine that's a colleague. His name's Robert. I know if he's going to cover for me, then I feel comfortable. He's going to do a good job. He's going to show up on time. He's going to relate to the client. He's going to understand the law. But if it's somebody that I don't know, Robert's not always available. If I have to have somebody else cover for me, there's not that same feeling of security, of safety. So when you go to God, is he known by you? Is he trusted by you? Do you have that sense of and that feeling of safety and security? In recent times, with all the weapons mankind has made, I read these articles about the ultra-rich building these luxury underground bomb shelters because that's where their trust is. But for us, we have God. He's promised to be a shelter. Do we trust him? Do we believe that? We must. Psalm 118, verse 8 says, it's better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in man. Saying, don't put your ultimate hope and trust in anything else. Not in your friends, not even in your parents or your family. Certainly not in a politician or political party. Don't place your trust in feeling superior over others, meaning, hey, this could never happen to me. This happens to other people. Don't place your trust in things like our homes, our electricity, our food. Remember that February storm that came through? How quickly can that vanish? But God's shelter, God's help will never fail. Don't place your trust in ignorance. If I just ignore all this, it's going to go away. No, we must watch. And as we see storms come up, we who know God must search him out and place all of our trust in him. I want us to keep this promise in our hearts and in our minds firmly, so we can go to him and say, God, where's the specific promise that you swore? I'm seeking you out. You are my shelter. I will trust in you. So this first promise, this first promise is a shelter from things going on around us. We have somebody else here that wants to speak, it looks like. Ooh, all right. He's protected me already from that wasp there. All right, so Psalm 118:8 says, okay, we read that. I just want to conclude the first promise. The first promise involves shelter from things around us, a protection from things around us. But what about all the things going on inside of us? What about the inner turmoil that we can feel? Please turn to Matthew 11. Matthew 11, you know, in this chapter, Jesus Christ is teaching in various cities. Multitudes are gathering around to hear him. He's saying, he who has ears, let him hear. In other words, what I'm saying here is important. Listen up. And this is promise number two we're about to read, and I'm going to read from the New American Standard Bible again. Matthew 11, verse 28 says this, "Come to me, all who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." So you've got this multitude gathered around, and Christ pours out this wonderful promise. Let's look at it. It's speaking to the people experiencing inner struggles. He's saying, are you exhausted? Are you worn down? Do you feel anxious and overloaded? The word that he uses, burden, there is derived from the cargo of a ship that literally weights it down. Are you feeling weighted down mentally or emotionally or psychologically? For me, reading too much of the news, yeah, makes me feel weighted down. I get this way too often. I think that's why God pointed me to this promise in particular. And what is that promise? Christ's promise is this: I'll give you rest. That's quiet inner rest. That means to be at peace. The opposite, the antonym, would be tormented. So just like that, am I no longer tormented and I'm just at peace, right? But I've tried praying and I'm still anxious. Well, let's look. The promise is sure. It says, I will give you rest. I will give your soul rest. So what's going on? Are we doing our part? Let's look at what our part is here. He says, first, come to me. That means to come to or toward. It requires us to put away distractions. Visualize being at your office desk or your school desk or on your couch, wherever it is, and you start feeling stressed and anxious. And Jesus Christ walks into the room and says, hey, come here. Are you going to approach him while you're still looking at your cell phone or with the TV and the news in the background? Probably not. But sometimes we'll go that way in prayer to God, still distracted. I thought about it. For me personally, when I'm still thinking on those things, it's almost like, you know, maybe I can control the situation. Maybe I can do something about it. I'll give you a silly example. I used to think if I watched my sports teams play, they would do better. Like I could control that some way. I believed it. But the key is you put away the distractions. You put away the need to control it yourself. So he says, come to me. He also says, take my yoke upon you. A yoke couples two things together. You might find yourself, if you stop back and think about it, what am I yoked to? Am I yoked to the world, where I'm trying to feel that pressure to keep up with everyone around me and the fast pace of life? If we want this promise, we cannot do that. We cannot be yoked to two things at one time. Picture that. It's impossible. That's why Christ says it's you cannot serve two masters. Look at what he says closely. He says, take my yoke upon you. He doesn't say, let me put my yoke upon you. I used to always kind of visualize it that way. Well, Christ is just going to yoke me in. No, he says, take my yoke upon you. It's our choice. It's our action that we must take. And when we do, Christ promises rest for our souls. So he uses the word rest twice, but that second time, a little bit different in the Greek. It means inward tranquility, but it means inward tranquility while you're performing the necessary labor. So there comes a responsibility here for us. I think of the parable of the talents. I think of the parable of the day laborer. There's an active part we must play. But note in verse 29, he said, I'm gentle, I'm humble. I'm going to be the best boss you ever had. Verse 30, we didn't read it, but we know it. He says, my burden is light. Emotionally, mentally, it's going to be so much lighter than many times it is for us when we're just trying to avoid God and do it our way. Consider Jonah. Thirdly, he says, learn from me. That means to understand thoroughly. It means consider very carefully. And how do you learn from someone? You spend time with them. If you're yoked to Christ, and you're working alongside him, you will get to know him. You will learn from him. So keep this promise firmly in your heart and mind. So if and when you find yourself anxious or afraid, instead of a general plea of God, please help me, you can go specifically and call out this specific promise from Jesus Christ. God, I seek rest. I seek peace. I'm laying aside every weight, every burden, and I'm coming to you and claiming this promise. I'll yoke myself to Christ, and as I do, please give my soul rest. You think God wouldn't hear that prayer? Bible says God is not slack concerning his promises. It also says all the promises of God are yes. What that means is yes, certainly. God says, yes, certainly I'll do this. So we've looked at two promises, one concerning the threats around us and being sheltered from that, and two, being anxious and burdened internally and receiving rest from that. With 5,400 promises, we could go on and on, but we'll look at one last promise, one that we can take with us going forward in our daily lives, no matter what's ahead. Please turn to Joshua chapter 1. We'll read promise number 3 here. You know, there's a group of people here in Joshua 1 that's been on a long journey. They're worn out. They're exhausted. The entrance into the promised land is imminent, but the circumstances are daunting. They've just lost the comfort of having their human leader, Moses. He passed away. There's uncertainty going forward. What's it look like for us? Our lives have changed. Meanwhile, remember, many of these Israelites were very anxious about the big challenge and about the obstacles ahead. As we know, anxiety within a group can be contagious. So as all these people are gathered here, remember, there's people of all ages there. Older, teenagers, young children. They're all there, and they're all in this together. And this promise God is about to make applies to all of us. In verse 2, he says, arise and go into this land, and then he makes his promise in verse 5. Joshua 1, verse 5, he says, no man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you. The promise is a simple one. I am with you. I will not leave you. It's simple and reassuring. But notice our part. Verse 6. He says, be strong and of good courage. Verse 7. Only be strong and very courageous. Verse 9. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and of good courage. Okay, so this must be important. He's repeating it 3 times. To be strong, which means to be or become firm. It's something that's often used to admonish soldiers to be strong before going into battle. We only do this by remembering God is with us. Remember in 1 Samuel 30, David strengthened himself in the Lord. It says, be of good courage. That means to be absolutely determined, no matter what. Now, verse 7, there's more included in our part. Joshua 1, verse 7, God also says, observe to do according to all the law. Verse 8, this book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate in it day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it. As we go forward, we've got to not only know God's laws, But we've got to do the God's laws. We've got to meditate on them. We've got to soak them in. We've got to talk about it with each other. And his final instruction, verse 9, says, "Do not be afraid nor dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go." He repeats his promise. And he says, don't be afraid. Don't tremble. This is the same word that's used in Deuteronomy 4 times before they're going to battle. Again, going to battle. Don't be afraid. I'm with you. I'm going to be fighting this battle. So this battle, the soldier's context keeps coming up. I think God's telling us, you know, look, there may be some tough things ahead. But be strong and courageous, because I promise I'm with you. The Israelite situation sounds a bit to me like our lives today. Things are challenging, a little bit uncertain. Can certainly see things changing. There's some fear and anxiety being pumped in at us all the time by the media. And yet we of all ages, it's our task to arise and go forward into God's kingdom. God says, as you do this, Psalm 121 verse 3 says, I will not allow your foot to slip. As you're going on your journey, I'm going to be there. I think of my 2-year-old daughter, Evelyn, and I at the park. She's climbing up on something. I'm calling out warnings to her. I'm there in case she happens to fall. God cares for us. He wants to be there with us. He wants to protect us and rescue us. The question we must ask ourselves is, do we want this promise? What do you mean by that? Well, do we want God to be with us at all times? Think about what that means. No matter what you're doing, no matter how you're treating other people, no matter how you're responding to different situations, do you want God right there? It means that we have to give up being our own God sometimes. We've got to look, what would Jesus do? What would the Father do? What does he want me to do? Wanting this promise and going and claiming it from God daily can actually help us change our behavior. It can help us to become a better Christian. And it can also give us confidence that no matter what's coming at us ahead, God is there with us. So go to God and claim this promise. You know, we're going to turn to a story that, to me, really provides a beautiful illustration of all the promises that we've discussed. Because there's a family member of ours whose choices and actions demonstrated the claiming of these promises. Just by the way they acted. By doing their part, and then you see God right there along with them, fulfilling the promises. Please turn to the book of Ruth. Right after the book of Judges is the book of Ruth. Her life progression and the actions she took, it just fits hand in glove with these promises. So let's add some context to Ruth's life before we start reading. She was not an Israelite. She was a Moabite. She grew up in Moab, a place that's rife with pagan gods and rituals, even child sacrifice to their god Moloch. But Ruth marries an Israelite, Mahlon, the son of Elimelech and Naomi, whose family had moved from Judah to Moab in order to avoid a famine. Now, presumably, Ruth gets to learn about, gets to talk about the true living God, right, from Mahlon and his family. But then sometime into their marriage, Mahlon dies. So she's lost her husband, and they don't have any children at that point. Meanwhile, Mahlon's brother Chilion also dies. That's not even to mention her father-in-law Elimelech also had died. So from Ruth's perspective, you've got to ask yourself, what's going on here? Is this family cursed? Or what is happening? And all that's left of this Judean family is the mother-in-law, Naomi. And Naomi announces she's too leaving Moab. She's going to return to Judah. So Ruth's life is in pretty severe chaos here. She's a young widow. She just had this significant losses in her life. And now the only one, presumably, in her life who knows the true God is leaving, forcing Ruth to decide, should I stay here in Moab with the comforts of my family, the way of life that I grew up in? Or should I rise up and go into this new land, the land of the living God? Sounds a lot like the challenge that Joshua and the Israelites had in promise number 3. Now keep in mind, if she decided to go into this land, she's arriving as a young widow and a stranger in a foreign country. What would you do if you were Ruth? Naomi gives Ruth and her sister-in-law Orpah some advice. Let's pick up in verse 8. Ruth 1, verse 8. Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return to your mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband." So she kissed them and lifted up their voices and wept. You know, they're weeping. It's certainly a difficult and trying time. And Naomi, you know, says, "May God be with you," right? Promise number 3. And she says, "May the Lord grant you rest." The Hebrew word there means peace, quiet. Sounds a lot like what Christ was offering in promise number 2. Let's skip forward for a moment to Ruth chapter 3, verse 1. So I want to show how this book sets up all of the promises we discussed. Ruth 3, verse 1. Naomi again speaking to Ruth. "Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to Ruth, 'My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you?' Remember, Ruth has arrived as a vulnerable young Moabite widow, and in these times, Israel wasn't necessarily a God-obeying place. The fact that Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord is repeated 6 times in the book of Judges, the same time period of Ruth. So Naomi's saying, we've got to find security for you. You need security. That word means a resting place, a safe place, a shelter. Sounds a lot like our first promise. So Ruth here, she has a need for all 3 of these promises. Let's go back to chapter 1. Let's look at her decision point here. Should she stay home in Moab or go to the land of the living God? Verse 11. "But Naomi said to Ruth and Orpah, 'Turn back, my daughters.'" So she's repeating her earlier advice. "Go back home to Moab." Verse 14. "Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And Naomi said, 'Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law.'" At this point, Ruth has every reason to go back to her old home in Moab now. There's her peer, her family member at this point, her sister-in-law is returning. Naomi's repeating a third time, "Go back and return to Moab." But what will she do? Will she stay or will she arise up and go to Judah? Where will she seek her rest and her shelter? As we know, verse 16, Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God shall be my God." Something in Ruth was telling her, arise up and move forward into the land of the living God. What do you think that was? I wonder if in learning about God from Naomi and her family, she had heard about the story of Joshua and the Israelites, how God promised them, arise up, go here, I'll be with you, and how that promise may apply to her. It's interesting that one of the very same Hebrew words found in God's instruction to Joshua and the Israelites is found right here in Ruth. Right in the same chapter, Ruth 1, verse 18, remember where we read God's instruction to be strong and very courageous? Well, that word courageous means determined, and it shows up in Ruth 1, verse 18. It says, when Naomi saw that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her. All right, I've tried to convince you 3 times. I see it's not going to, you're not changing your mind, you're determined. It's the exact instruction that God, in the very attitude God encouraged Jacob and the Israelites, or sorry, Joshua and the Israelites to have. She was doing her part without even knowing it, probably her part in these promises. If you look through the book of Ruth, she's doing this time and time again. She's coupling herself, yoking herself to Boaz there, right, who is a type of Christ. She's staying in his field and his field only. Right? Not 2 different places. That's where she's staying. She gleans in his field, meaning she's doing the necessary labor. She goes to him and lays at his feet. Remember, she's a stranger. She's placing her trust in him. She's doing her part, and God is fulfilling his promises through Boaz. Let's briefly glance at some of the scriptures that show that. Ruth 2, verse 9. Boaz has told Ruth, look, come work in my field, stay there. And middle of verse 9, he says, Have I not commanded the young men not to touch you? And when you're thirsty, go to the vessels and drink from what the young men have drawn? In other words, I'm going to protect you. I'm going to be a shelter for you from starvation, from those that might seek to harm you. And remember Christ. He promises us, as you work alongside me, I'll be gentle and humble. My burden will be light. Look at verse 16. We see that in Boaz. Verse 16 says, let grain, Boaz talking to his men, let grain fall from the bundles purposefully for her. Leave it that she may glean. He's saying, look, she's yoked herself to me. We're coupled. And as she works her portion in the field, I will supply the rest to her abundantly. I'm going to make it easier for her, lighter. Another example is found in Ruth 3:18. Boaz's character here, God fulfilling promises. Naomi's statement here, Ruth 3 verse 18 says, sit still, my daughter, for the man will not rest until he has concluded the matter this day. God does not rest. Jesus and his Father are working to our benefit and will complete the work that they started in us. Ultimately, we know what happens. Boaz never abandons Ruth, but rather marries her. And Ruth's uncertain situation becomes stabilized. She's found a protector and a redeemer. Instead of being a young widow, not knowing anyone but Naomi, she's now married to a strong and upstanding Boaz who is well established in the land. She and Boaz then, of course, have a son who turns out to be the grandfather of David, who happens to be in the physical lineage of Jesus Christ. It's a beautiful example. Ruth's life path is instructive for us, not only the women in the congregation, but for all of us here, as we all seek to be the bride of Christ. Her example shows us that if we're strong, if we're courageous and determined to walk with God and work alongside him, if we put our trust in him, he will be with us. He'll be our shelter. He'll give us rest. He shows us, God shows us through Ruth's story, I'm going to be faithful, fulfilling my promises. Remember, the God who created everything has given us 5,400 promises. It's incredible, and it makes me wonder, how must he feel if I'm not going to him with thankfulness and eagerness to claim these specific promises? Now, 5,400 is a lot, so I suggest not overwhelming yourself with all 54, or even perhaps all three of these. Start with one. Start with one promise. Get to know it. Live it. And try God and see. Is he faithful? This process will build your faith. It will strengthen your relationship with God and Jesus Christ. It will increase the oil in your lamp. In Paul's letter to the Romans, he says, Abraham did not waver at the promise of God through unbelief, but was strengthened in faith, being fully convinced that what God had promised, he was able to perform. Are we fully convinced that God will perform his promises for us? Not for anyone else, for us. Are you convinced of that? If so, what's stopping us from going to God and claiming those promises? When I think of God's promises, I can't help but think of the song, Standing on the Promises of God. And as I was preparing this message, I was watching clips of various groups singing this song from Africa, Asia, all around the world. And I started to think about our brethren that we've started to get to know a little bit better in Malawi and Zambia. Personally, I started to think about some of my family members in Australia and my good friend in Italy. We all have various people that we can think of around the world that are standing on the promises of God right now. And as we started this message, reading about the destructive times of Asaph and the daunting times that Christ speaks of, let's close with the image of our glorious future. 1 Corinthians 15 will take place. All of us around the world that are standing on the promises of God, we're all going to rise and meet Christ at his return. God will fulfill his ultimate promise found in 1 John 2 of eternal life. So no matter how daunting the circumstances around you might be right now or that you might find in the future, no matter how anxious or stressed you are or become. No matter what lies ahead for this country or for this world, may you always go to God boldly and confidently. May he swiftly answer you. May he be your shelter. May he give you rest and peace. May God be with you all to the end. Amen.